Hello, 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 beloved listeners. This is your host, Kenneth Lesser, welcoming you to another Advanced Living Radio program. So excited on this beautiful new month of December, the final month of wrapping up a year, as we get kind of sometimes busy in the holidays, and there's so much going on. How can we find a way to really take into account the important things in our lives to kind of get centered and grounded? Well, today we have a wonderful, wonderful guest, Michael Gellert, an author, and he is going to support us with some amazing, amazing information. Now, for those of you that aren't familiar with him yet, Michael Gellert is a Jungian analyst, and he's practicing in Los Angeles and Pasadena, California. He treats individuals, couples, and offers psychotherapy groups, and also, because he's an author of several popular books, a writing workshop. And he was a former director of training at the C.G. Jung Institute of Los Angeles, where he is currently a research instructor. A great grounding in a powerful, powerful psychological tool. And he's been a humanities professor at Vanier College, Montreal, and a lecturer in religious studies at Hunter College of the City University of New York. And prior to living in Los Angeles, he lived in New York City, where he supervised District Council 37's Personal Service Unit Outreach Program, which is an employee assistance program for employees of the City of New York. So he's played in some big venues here. And over the years, he has served as a mental health consultant to various organizations, including the University of Southern California and Time Magazine. Now Michael Gellert himself was born and raised in Montreal. He was educated in Rabbinic Judaism, traveled overland from Europe to India at age 19. That's quite a journey. Studied theology at Loyola College in Montreal, and trained with renowned Zen master Kon Yamada in Japan for 2 years. And he has master's degrees in religious studies and social work. And he studied with Marshall McLuhan at the University of Toronto. And he is the author of Modern Mysticism, The Fate of America, and a book that we'll discuss today, which really kind of gets our curiosity going, The Way of the Small. And he lectures widely on psychology, religion, and contemporary culture. So here we go on an adventure, my beloved listeners. Welcome, welcome, Michael.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ken.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm intrigued, of course, because the title of your book, The Way of the Small, Why Less is Truly More, and that got my attention, because my name is Kenneth Lesser, and I joke with people and tell them my motto is, you get more with lesser.
So you got a head start.
Yes. So tell me, how would you describe The Way of the Small?
Well, the way of the small is a term I use that I borrow from the different religions of the world. They all teach, in their own words, the value of living small, of living within our means, focusing on details, appreciating the little things of life. You could say that the biggest problem we have today that underlies our many different problems is that we live in an age of grandiosity. And what the way of the small is, it's a response to that. That helps us live more modestly and to find happiness with what we have rather than always running after more, more, and more.
Ah, okay. Yeah, because, wow, talking about this more, 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 it's kind of reminiscent of the idea of the American dream and an insatiable shopping passion. Now, obviously, I'm guessing the way of the small kind of flies in the face of this American dream. Could you go into that a little bit?
It does fly in the face of the American dream, or rather, what the American dream has become. When Jefferson described the pursuit of happiness as one of the basic rights of Americans, in his lifetime, he didn't foresee what it would lead to. That was a vision that he had of happiness that was integrating the search for material affluence, but integrating it with spiritual well-being, with refinement and culture, with higher values. Today we see over the last couple of centuries, and particularly the last few decades, a one-sidedness where the spiritual dimension of the pursuit of happiness has receded into the background, and all we have today is this focus on material fulfillment. So this is creating a situation that splits the human condition in half. So it's very interesting that America, a nation that puts the pursuit of happiness as the high point of its dream, is a nation that also has possibly the highest rate of clinical depression and anxiety in the world, because
Ooh.
It's an imbalance.
The way that we've been conditioned to pursue happiness versus the way it was offered, I guess, at the founding of our country. Is that kind of what you're saying a little bit?
Yes. Well, the term the pursuit of happiness was something Jefferson borrowed from the English philosopher John Locke. It meant the freedom to pursue material well-being, but it was implicitly understood by all the founding fathers, who were men of high culture and men who had a very particular vision for the American civilization. It was understood by all of them that this would be balanced by a strong spiritual foundation. In fact, if you look on the reverse side of the American bill, the $1 bill, you will see the pyramid. That pyramid has as its base the material fulfillment of happiness, but as you get up towards the peak, that was a symbol for spiritual well-being. And the founding fathers, when they envisioned the American vision or the dream, had this two-sided view of happiness, and today we've become very one-sided.
Ah. Now, so we, obviously, when we look at our culture and the diminishing role that we're playing in the world, from a once most powerful nation in the world to now one with economic problems, a devaluating dollar, I mean, there's some serious things. So, obviously, we've got to get back on track, and I'm guessing that this is some of what you offer in the way of the small.
This is these are all themes that come up. If you look at our federal deficit today, I think it's something like $9 trillion. That's a lot of zeros. Why is it that we are living beyond our means? We don't have to. And these are problems that we'll be paying for generations from now unless we get our handle on them.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So, I mean, that's, obviously something very large in scope. And I know so many of us have to focus, okay, well, what can I do personally? So I'm wondering, what role does the way of the small play in our everyday lives?
Well, it helps us to size down our expectations of what will make us happy and focus on the small things in life that are important, whether this is focusing on the step that's immediately in front of us instead of worrying about things far down the road. We need to worry about things. We need to plan for the future, but we also need to savor the present. We need to slow down. Most of us lead a very fast-paced life today and ask ourselves basic questions like, how is my life overly complicated? Where is it too much, too imbalanced? Are my days too busy, too crowded, too rushed? Do I take one step at a time? These are all questions that all the great American philosophers, as well as philosophers all over the world, have always talked about. And you could think of Henry David Thoreau, for example, as somebody who really was a living icon in his day of the way of the small.
Ah, interesting. And now one of the things when you were talking about, I guess, like our happiness, I was looking here on page 124 of your book, which we can order if we go to. Is it Michael Gellert, michaelgellert.com?
Yes, right? That's the website, and the book can be ordered there as well.
Okay.
As directly from Amazon or anywhere else.
Oh, all righty. Well, you're talking some here about happiness, and it's so important about how we see things. There's a sentence in here, to crave what you don't have is to cast a shadow where there is none. To not enjoy what you have is to not appreciate the light.
Exactly, exactly. See, the way of the small is about living according to the life that is put in front of us each day. So if we are taking an approach that is always wanting something that we don't have, you know, tomorrow it will be better, or if only I got this, I would be happy. It could be a bigger car, a better vacation, a different spouse. It's always something more, 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 rather than living within the means and the limits of what is really right before us. So when we live like that, we don't appreciate the things in front of us. We don't see the light that's really there. And that's actually a source of great unhappiness.
Mm. Okay, so it's like constantly or frequently diminishing what we do have compared to what we'd like to have.
You could say that. You could say that. That, you know, the way of the small is a kind of active, creative diminishing that we voluntarily take on ourselves in order to live fully in our skin. But the diminishing can go the other way, too, so that if you don't appreciate the good things that are available to you, it's exactly as you describe it.
Wow. Wow, it makes me kind of curious, because I think a number of the spiritual practices really talk about be grateful for what you have. Whether if people have seen that recent DVD, The Secret, it was emphasized in that, or What the Bleep Do We Know. Now you're talking about appreciation for what is. Have gratitude for where you're at, and then I'm guessing using that is helping us to connect to our spiritual nature, or what do you?
Yes, and on a practical level, being small or living small involves a host of disciplines that you find in all the great religions, and even in disciplines like science and the mastery of sports or playing an instrument. It involves penetrating the moment, being attentive to what is required in the details. You know, the saying that God is in the details, or Zen is in the details, the devil is in the details. any ruling principle, the it's all in the details. So this is one of the focal ways that the way of the small comes alive every day in our lives.
Okay. Now, I'm just kind of curious because, like in the book, and you're talking a little bit briefly here about that we can, I guess, be satisfied with where we're at, live within our means, and you talk about that as you know, helping to open up our lives and to be liberated by that. And there's even some things in the book about reminding us of in the universe how insignificant we are, and yet to not be discouraged by that, but to use that to our advantage. Can you help fill that in a little bit?
Well, for sure, when we look at the vastness of this cosmos, somebody once said that it's like driving in a car 90 miles an hour by a field, and there's a fly on the back of a cow. You're there and you're gone in a moment. Our lives are very brief blips in this cosmos whose vastness we can barely imagine. Yet, on the other hand, and the vastness is not only going in a macrocosmic direction, it goes microcosmically as well. You go down to the cellular level and then the molecular and atomic level, and now we have quarks, and even beyond that, we find out that the small littleness in the cosmos is also very huge. So how do we find meaning in this vast, vast cosmos? The human dimension is actually a very small slice between the macrocosmic and the microcosmic. And in that human dimension where we live with our day-to-day experiences, our challenges of how to become fulfilled people and to make a contribution to other people's lives, to live morally, to educate ourselves, to individuate, to become psychologically whole, all of these day-to-day challenges, this is the human dimension, and only by being small in a very full way and inhabiting our humanness do we really realize its capacity and live it in a very fulfilling way. So the way of the small is a way to inhabit the human slice of smallness that we have in this very vast cosmos.
Mm. Wow. Okay, and then to use that to our advantage, I'm understanding, to make peace with that, so that we don't have to go around seeking this grandiose lifestyle that we might get someday, but yearning for it can destroy all the joy of life.
Well, yes, so much of you know, the history of philosophy and of people's personal religious searches have been to find some meaning in life. And just like with the pursuit of happiness, there's a tendency to be very big about this. But if you listen to the great masters, what you discover is that they're all encouraging us to be smaller. I think Jesus had the saying in the Gospel of Thomas that he who understands what it means to be small has found the kingdom of heaven. And you find similar aphorisms in every tradition.
Okay. I wasn't familiar with that one, but it definitely ties in. I know. Now, one of the things that I'm wondering...
If I could just add, you mentioned you weren't familiar with that one. It's an apocryphal gospel, but I think in the book of Matthew and Mark, there's that, and I cite this in the chapter I have on religion, where Jesus says that the mustard seed, heaven is like a mustard seed. The kingdom of God is like a mustard seed. It begins very, very small, and slowly it grows. And that's a reference, really, to the way of the small.
And then I guess the idea that if we have faith, the size of a mustard seed that we could move mountains?
That's right. There's a reference to that as well. There's a number of wonderful passages in the Bible that, the highest mountains shall be raised down and the valley shall be raised, or the meek shall inherit the earth. It's a reference to humility, which is a quality of the way of the small. These are all speaking to the importance of making a correct assessment of our limits and our humanity and living within those in a modest way.
Ah, and then using that as a springboard so that we can go forward, we might achieve great things, and yet we can do what we're doing from a place of comfort, if I'm hearing you correctly, day in and day out comfort and acceptance of where we're at and actually celebration of where we're at rather than yearning for what we don't have.
Exactly. Exactly.
Huh. Wow. Makes it a lot easier to get up each day feeling peaceful with ourselves if we can accept that.
Well, this is the funny thing about all schools of mysticism. They teach the simplest things, you know, to give up attachments that are not necessary, to live modestly, to take one day at a time, to love each other in a way that's not self-serving. But as is the case, all the simple things in life are the hardest to put into practice. It's easier said than done.
Yeah. Yes, well, I'm wondering because so many people with the way life has been, and you mentioned, I mean, some like in your book, you know, some of the things related to the Holocaust in Germany, and you know, which is of course a huge tragedy with a tremendous hardship, and then people just in their own lives. Challenges. It seems like there was actually an interview, and this one is a kind of a shocking fact, that a number of people who were, I think, above $30 million in their net worth were interviewed, and it turned out that the majority of those people were frightened and insecure. And so it's sort of like, well, geez, if that's going on for people with $30-plus million dollars, what's going on for the rest of us that might not have reached that level yet with some of the struggles of life? So I'm wondering what can we do? I mean, failures, illness, loss of a loved one. Last I looked in the mirror, I'm getting older. How can we turn to you and the way of the small for some help here?
Well, you know, you said something that made me think of a line from a Sheryl Crow song. I think it goes, it's not getting what you want, it's wanting what you have. That the more we have, of course, these are all blessings in life. You know, even the ancients and Jefferson and all those people never said that if affluence comes your way, to throw it away. The problem is not affluence or being wealthy. It's being attached to it in a one-sided way to the exclusion of spiritual fulfillment. Because, you see, if you're just fulfilling yourself materially, that spiritual side of you is going to be hungry unconsciously, if not consciously. And that is why I think those people who have $30 million are so anxious. Because the more you have, if that is all you have, then the more you believe you need to have in order to keep it. You know, you have to maintain these sort of things. And because there's only so much fulfillment they can do, and we have equated in our minds that we always need more, we're in a conundrum. So that the more you get, again, the more you want. So it becomes a never-ending cycle. The way of the small is very simply a way to accept that there are limits to everything, and if you have reached a comfortable zone or limit in your life where you are making enough to put food on your table and live well and pay your taxes and put away for a rainy day and take care of your retirement plan and all the things that are actually luxuries by historical standards today, then the question people need to ask themselves, if it's the case with them, why is that not enough? And that sends people into an inquiry into the spiritual side of things and also the way the small. But, you know, I wanted to respond to something you said, Ken, also that is related to this. You mentioned the Holocaust and so forth. You know, a lot of the historical atrocities that have happened and are still happening today come from the same problem that people are very grandiose, very inflated. The Holocaust was perhaps history's most glaring example of inflation, you know, that they thought they could do whatever they wanted and any way they wanted. This is an old, old impulse in the human psyche, and it begins with the Tower of Babel in the book of Genesis. There's this hunger in the human heart to become like God, or what we think is God, to become greater than we really are. And that search to be godlike is very different than what the mystics, for example, are talking about when they say, find your godhood. That's two very different things. So the aspiration to be greater and greater beyond our limits is a source of much of the world's problems today, whether it's the federal deficit, which we earlier talked about, or the wars that plague our planet, the genocides that are going on. Our ecological problem is really a problem of living too big beyond our means, and you know, to curtail the global warming today will require a change of thinking that really is the way of the small.
Now, one of the things that comes up as a curiosity, I'm not sure how your efforts and perhaps others that you, you know, bond together with in this philosophy can be of support. I was at a workshop recently, and they were explaining that with the growth in India, the growth in China, that that the already stretched oil reserves, that the demand for that is going to increase exponentially as those cultures blossom, creating even more pressure and the desire in those countries for people to be larger and larger consumers. That's apparently a huge pressure that's moving towards us. And I'm just thinking, oh, ouch, that's not helping us to go smaller.
No, absolutely not. And of course, the third world countries are all saying that why should they be forced to cut back and to start, you know, moderating their industrial output to reduce pollution when the developed countries have gotten so far ahead and caused a lot of this problem. With regard to the oil question, you know, the geologists have made it pretty clear that we are already almost at the peak of what they call the oil production peak, which means that all the oil reserves that are believed to be in the earth, we've consumed about half of that now. So whatever oil we're now going to be consuming on the planet, we're depleting the remaining half that's left. So that is part of the concern people have, that the developing countries, China and India, are expanding the way they are because the oil depletion is going to be happening quicker than we anticipated. But all this speaks to the question of, you know, what in the ecology movement is called sustainable living, what Al Gore is talking about in his film, and then there was this recent film by Leonardo DiCaprio.
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 pronounce his name, The 11th Hour. It's a wonderful film. All of this points to the fact that we need to begin to think differently about how we're living on the planet, how we are using the resources, and what are we going to do to live in a way that doesn't, on the one hand, completely deplete the planet, and on the other, make us have to return to living in a kind of a Stone Age condition. I think the way of the small and the kind of research that's going on in the Silicon Valley and all over the world now, people are beginning to speak about how we could live in a way that's in harmony with the Earth. All of it will require us to be smaller, to waste less, to think more frugally. In Henry David's Thoreau Day, the word thrift meant two things. It meant to be frugal, but also to thrive by being frugal. Today we think of thrift only as being frugal, but we need to begin to find ways to live frugally and to thrive at the same time. And that really, that is what the way of the small, living small, is about.
Wow. Michael, that's so important, because as you were saying that, and I wonder for how many of us, as you've made mention, this thirst to find fulfillment in our lives through consumerism. I'm only so many purchases away from true enlightenment or full happiness. And then when the more someone buys, or you know, how many millions, what does a millionaire want? Oh, more money, 2 million. And then we're seeing where that's leading in the world. And so, here when you say living within your means, it's sort of like to be able to come to a place where we feel this joy for what we have, and to find a lot of fulfillment in our spiritual lives, so that we don't have to consume ourselves to death in a useless quest for happiness, which never gets it there. Well, this is huge.
Yeah,
what you're talking about.
You know, living small is about integrating a spiritual life with a material life. It's not one or the other. It's the two together in a creative way.
Now, do you have anything that we might be offering, you know, for myself or our listeners, for the people that you interact with, on like some initial steps, if there were one, two, three things that a person can do to, I don't know, if we take an assessment of our lives, if we take certain steps, can you help so that I can be happier being smaller, being happier with what I've got?
Well, one of the exercises I ask patients to do, and I describe it in the book, is I ask them to sit down and write a little contemplative essay or even a paragraph on three questions. How can I be small or smaller in my work life, in my career? Then the second question, how can I be smaller in my marriage and in my personal life and my relationships, in my family life? That's the personal dimension. And then the third question, how can I be smaller, how can I practice the way of the small spiritually in terms of my personal growth, my development, my inner spiritual and ethical development, and to sit down and think about this and write about it. It should be a practical exercise that speaks to what is actually going on in the individual's life. I don't think any two people will necessarily come up with the same answers, because everybody has a different life. So that's a good start, because it could tell somebody where they're too big, you know, Where is there too much in their lives? Are they socializing too much? Are they spending too much time at work? Are they living beyond their means and constantly working to pay up that credit card debt? Are they not devoting enough time to inner well-being, whether that's in the form of relaxing more or exercising regularly or meditating or praying or doing art, whatever it is that brings somebody a sense of spiritual fulfillment. So this is a sort of a, what in the 12 steps program, I suppose is called taking an inventory of oneself.
Okay.
It's a good start. In the rest of the book, I offer a number of different principles or themes with which one can look at their lives and see if these principles are being optimally lived. Some people will be focusing a great deal on details. If you look at some of the professions, dentists, engineers, surgeons, these are people who work with details all day long. But others may need to pay greater attention to the details in their lives, you know, what is going on with their children at school, what is going on in their backyard, so to speak, both, you know, in terms of literally what's in their backyard, if they want to be gardening or doing something for relaxation, and the backyard of what we're not aware of, you know, what's things we are overlooking in our lives that need attention.
Wow. And so help getting this book, The Way of the Small, on Amazon or at michaelgellert.com. By reading this, we're going to have a way to actually follow some guidelines to take some of the pressure off of our lives, if I'm hearing you correctly, and to manage our lives better and to be more grateful with what we have, and in some instances, I guess, even reshape the way we're living so that we're less consumer-oriented. Is that some of what you're saying?
Yes, the principles are guidelines. They're practical guidelines that cut across different aspects of our lives. They have implications for our relationships. I have a section on love and the way of the small. It's called Learning to Love Vulnerably. That's very important because so often in our personal relationships, we don't really expose ourselves, we don't share, we don't tolerate other people's imperfections. To really have love in your life and to express love, you need to size down and become very vulnerable, and to tolerate your vulnerability means you need to be small, you need to be open. Other ways that the way of the small is very helpful are through principles such as embracing diminishment. Diminishment is something people naturally run away from because who likes to feel small? But everyday life is really has so much in it that makes us feel small. Aging or illness, or the death of a loved one, a divorce, failing at a business or some other project. All these things, which are just part of everyday life, naturally make us feel insignificant at times, or feel small, feel less than we would like to be. The human impulse is to hide from these things from ourselves. You know, falling into a depression is also something that people try to get out of as quick as they can. They medicate themselves, they go shopping, they do everything that they can to avoid tolerating it. The way of the small, particularly the principle here of embracing diminishment, is about not resisting these things that happen to us that make us feel small, and to letting them into our lives and asking questions such as, what might this mean right now that this is happening to me? What is life trying to tell me? What if I'm finding myself in a depression, for example, what is the psyche trying to tell me with that? What is the meaning of it? So embracing diminishment is a very important facet for the darker aspects of life. So you see here that the way of the small is very helpful with the pursuit of positive things such as happiness and success and a proper place in the world. But it's also important with the darker aspects when life takes something away from us and diminishes us. How do we cope with that?
Yeah.
That's very much
that sounds,
part of what we're talking about.
That's so important. Now, so can I don't know if you'd be able to share without giving any names or anything of perhaps some people that you've worked with and, you know, and how they've maybe gone through some challenges and followed your advice and had some good things happen. I'm intrigued because that, you know, it'd give me a way to understand a little more through someone else's experience how they've succeeded following these principles.
Well, in the book, I give a number of different stories from patients I've worked with to highlight the different principles. I think a psychotherapist is probably practicing the way of the small with his or her patients every day, because so much of the problems we have are not that life brings us problems, but our attitude of how we look at those problems, how we respond to those problems. So what the way of the small does, it helps us to slow down and focus on these particular everyday problems. A couple of examples. I worked with a patient who was going through an empty nest syndrome. Her children had grown up and left home, and there was nothing left for her to meaningfully occupy her days. It took a long time to accept that loss and to not fight it.
Yeah.
The tendency for her was to go against the current of life, but the current here was telling her to give up and let go. So as she began to accept that and focus on what was in her life or a possibility in her life that she hadn't yet considered, she began to turn her life around and create a second half of life that was meaningful. She developed a business. She developed new friendships. She went ahead and created a new life or a life of meaning for herself. But that required for her to first accept that her life had been diminished and to embrace the diminishment. Another example might be, and this is very, very common, somebody comes into the therapist's office and they're depressed. They want to find a way out of it. But by going into their life history, going into what's going on in their life right now, they begin to discover, well, you know, maybe there's a reason why I'm depressed. And to start taking the details of that one by one and addressing them and finding ways to respond to them helps one to get to the root of the depression.
Ah, okay. So really doing a reality check.
Doing a reality check and listening to the, or discovering the reality of the deep psyche. You know, when you can often look into your dreams and see the symbols or the stories that are going on are often speaking to places in our lives where there's too much going on, where we're overdoing something, where we're doing something that the unconscious might be having a reaction to. So if we can identify those themes or symbols of largeness in our dreams and try to get a sense of what the psyche is asking of us, maybe to give something up, maybe to do something differently, then we could size down and things could shift. So these are some of the ways that in everyday life one can really begin to see if the way of the small might be something that would help them.
Ah, now I'm curious. Let's say someone is coming to you, that they go, they've heard our program, or they get your book, The Way of the Small by Michael Gellert. Go to michaelgellert.com, and that's G-E-L-L-E-R-T. And then they're coming and getting support, I think, on an initial mental and emotional level to be find peace with their circumstance in life, and to and then to move ahead in reorganizing some things. Now, I don't know, do you help support, refer them to other resources if they needed some help with whatever financial reorganizing or this, that, or the other? I don't know if, you know, if there's any sort of comprehensive approach, or if you're focusing, you know, mostly on the piece of kind of getting someone mentally and emotionally aligned with reorganizing their lives.
Well, I listen to what each person has to say about what they feel is their life situation and what brought them to the particular point in life that they're at that they feel is a problem and that they're coming to me for help with. And if it requires something additional, then our work together, for example, somebody needs to go for, you know, some budget counseling or financial planning, or needs to be evaluated for medication for anxiety, or somebody has a gambling problem, whatever it is, if there is some external source of help in addition to what I provide that I think would be appropriate and that the person thinks would be appropriate, I would make the recommendation. So, you know, there are many ways to skin a cat, many ways to approach a problem, and you don't want to do too much there, because even in psychotherapy, less is more, simpler is better, is very often the case. People often come into the therapist's office and they're overwhelmed by life, and I would not add more stress on to that unless clearly the additional help would really help the person to become smaller and to be able to do the work in the office with me, which is very much you know, a process of helping them to identify and explore what they feel will help them, how they feel they can also help themselves.
Ah, okay. So to me, if I'm hearing correctly, you can call on other resources, but I know for myself and others that I've dealt with, to move ahead on a goal requires typically inner alignment, and it sounds like someone coming to you would be supported to make decisions and then feel good about making those decisions, so that when they did do some things in their lives, you'd be supporting them to feel good about those decisions, so that they could move ahead and have a higher degree of success than just going to some credit counselor or some other program for, you know, for helping organize their lives, but that they may not be aligned with it, or they may be embarrassed having to do it. And if I'm hearing correctly, by coming to you, we can actually get to celebrate these shifts in our lives and approach them as something that's going to bring us greater happiness.
Yes, well, the important thing is not to get caught, for people not to get caught up in, again, these external band-aids, quick gratification solutions to problems, but to really begin to understand the inner dimension of what got them into the situation to begin with. So your term inner alignment is very appropriate there. And what is it that's being aligned? Well, within ourselves, one of the most important alignments that can happen in the therapy process is between the person, the waking mind, the ego, and their own unconscious, the dream life, the source of intelligence within themselves that creates these meaningful dreams. I mean, most people may not immediately understand what every one of their dreams means, but I think most people intuitively recognize that there's something very valuable in their dreams. So to align what that intelligence is trying to say deep within us with our everyday minds, I think is the beginning place where out of that radiates our solutions to our everyday external problems. You know, if we approach the outer world with our inner compass aligned, as you say, then we have a sense of direction and input from the inner psyche that can only help us in the long run.
Mm. Interesting. One of the things that was coming up, I was at a conference, and a gentleman who was coaching people on getting greater success in their lives found that a number of the people, when they were managing their lives, he basically said to them, men and women, that oftentimes they were managing their lives like little children. And in listening to you today, it's kind of starting to tie back in that being mature versus the child, because if I'm, you know, and I just wanted to get some feedback from you here, Michael, because I'm thinking a consumer-based society, to me, almost sounds in some ways like this insatiable child, this part of our childhood, gimme, 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 me, that is leading us in a direction of some serious consequences. And I don't know if that makes any sense from based on, you know, what you're talking about as the way of the small helping us to become more mature, or, you know, or is consumerism kind of like this childlike insatiable nature?
It's very important the point you're raising, Ken. You know, maturity with regard to what we're talking about, Carl Jung once said that the goal of personal development is for the ego to be as strong as possible and as small as possible. In other words, to be as uninflated, to not be grandiose, to be as really realistically oriented and living within one's skin as possible, but to also be strong. And he implied that the one leads to the other. You know, there's that other aphorism that Jesus said, lest ye be like children, ye shall not inherit the kingdom of heaven. That can also be taken as an allusion to the way of the small. But he wasn't advising people to be childish. There's a big difference between being childish and childlike. Childlike is, in a sense, also what the wise old man is. When you look at some of these popular figures in the media, like Yoda in Star Wars, he's a wise old figure, but he's also very childlike. He's small. So I think you're right that when we're grandiose and we're not strong, and we look at problems in a very superficial way, which leads to things like consumerism. It's a quick fix for whatever's bothering us. Go out, go shopping. What happens is our lives become, in terms of spiritual fulfillment, smaller and smaller, in the sense that it's insubstantial, but it's not small in a strong way. And it lacks that kind of maturity that you're referring to.
Ah, okay. Hmm. Wow. Well, I think it's just fabulous getting this opportunity to get reminded that that simplifying this way of the small, that that there's a whole lot of value in that, and the timing of this is perfect because for many people, I mean millions of people in our economy, it looks like it's going to be important to be able to readjust lifestyle and to be able to do it in a way where we're not grumbling every day or hating ourselves for doing it, or but to find some peace in it and some joy. And so having you bring to myself and our listeners here the way of the small, I think is just perfect timing for what our culture is going through. And I, Michael, I want to thank you so much for all the work you're doing, and invite you know, people to get your book, go to michaelgeller.com, and to benefit from that, and to know that they can go onto your website and contact you for counseling. And do you do that only with people one-on-one in your office, or can people call in from different parts of the country?
Of course, it's always preferable to be sitting in a person with a person in a room together face to face. Initially, I almost always prefer that, but I do work with people over the telephone. I have done some extended work on the telephone in certain circumstances.
Okay, I didn't know if Jungian principles would actually go across country, but apparently they can.
Well, it's the collective unconscious, so it's all around us.
Oh, good. Well, I just want to thank you, Michael, for taking time out of your busy schedule to bless us with the way of the small and this information that we can, in the midst of this season, find the more gifts that are already present in our lives, rather than go out and shop to find out what else we can do, is to start to give us this ourselves for this holiday season the gift of discovering the blessings that are already there in our lives.
Well, and thank you very much for having me on your show.
You're welcome, and wish you a happy holiday season. And my beloved listeners, tune in next week for more fun and adventures in Advanced Living Radio. God bless you all, and goodbye for now.
Let's go out.
Maybe they don't want to. But
well, you still have fans here, you know. This is for all the fans in Germany, actually. This is Senior Sieber calling. I don't need to tell who I am because everybody here knows it anyway. But there's German fans who really want to hear Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy show on bbsradio.com.
Okay, I'm going to read the words a little slowly at first.
But the light of the whole world dies.